Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Welcome, everyone. We are live on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, and I am getting an echo. It must be an important reason. I know that we have cloudy skies and rainy skies, so the airwaves are reverberating with news today, and it is January 17th, 2013. A good day. Thank you for listening to these free informative broadcasts, and you can be part of this educational movement to let people know the other side of the story. We're going to have Greg Glazer on today, and he is a constitutional lawyer from Copperopolis, California, also the founder of Civil Action Network, an independent media organization offering coordinated citizens referenda to promote justice, liberty, and sustainable living, and he is an example of that. You can visit his website at www.civilactionnetwork.org. And we also have our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina. And of course, I always introduce him as a special guest. He's one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys, advises individuals, families, attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights, supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice, and is a published internationally known figure on vaccine health and legal matters. If you need him to speak at your rally or conference, he is available in between his busy practice. And you can find him on pandemicresponseproject.com and vaccinerights.com. So we are set to go on our topic today, which is tyranny, is the big word that will bring people in to listen to us today. Hello.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello there.
Greetings. Welcome, Debbie. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, Alan.
We're ready to get started, and I'm going to sit back and listen to you two go at it.
Sure. Yeah, so today's topic is called Natural Living, Considered Unlawful by a Dangerous Minority of Militaristic Officials, who are presently unsuccessfully advocating rules for forced medical treatment and testing. And the question is, will they impose their rules for forced testing and treatment regardless of majority opposition and established law? And I'm going to be highlighting research today that discusses who those militaristic officials are and what they have written, which tries to take away the right to be peacefully natural, and where exactly that those laws are codified by statute. And then I'm also going to be discussing health freedom, where health freedom is also written into the law. And at the conclusion of the show, if you make it through, you're going to see or you're going to hear that there is a dichotomy or a battle going on between forces for medical freedom and forces for medical for forced medical treatment, which is also called involuntary treatment. And this battle that is being waged between these two forces is going to be decided on the ground and in the courts. And it's decided on the ground in the moment, and it's decided in the courts after years of struggle. And so the people will get to choose what it is that they want. And they do this politically. It's happened in the past through countless quarantine measures. It's all the way back to the early founding of the country. And we see it going up through a major example in World War II. And you can see the ebb and flow in history on this exact issue. And today, in 2013, the issues are different than they were back when many of these legal authorities were set. You know, if I look to legal authorities back at the founding of the country, you know, that's going to be talking about, you know, ships coming into port and, you know, quarantine measures on diseases that we don't really hear about today. Or if I go back to World War II, we're going to be talking about the internment of Japanese citizens. And but today we're going to be talking about the issues that come up today are things like bioterrorism and major programs to fund natural disaster relief and stuff like that. And the tools used by public health officials are much more involved. You know, we're in the computer age, we're in the laboratory age, and these are game changers in the field of public health. And public health authorities who make a living doing what they do, it's a very involved industry. They have their own public health publications that come out on a monthly basis, routine basis. There's a massive apparatus within the United States government, within state governments to promote emergency preparedness. And the way that it works is, and I can speak to this from what I read and also from a little bit of personal experience that I have. It's kind of like this. The whole infrastructure is built around the idea of funding programs, the whole emergency preparedness infrastructure. And the authority for each program is triggered by a different event, so like a bioterrorism event or a natural disaster event. And so the authorities who do this professionally learn to follow the money. And, you know, my experience going to local government meetings, I don't know anyone else who goes to local government meetings and goes to, like, emergency preparedness stuff and looks into it just to see what's going on. But my experience has been that local governments will designate a person or a group. It's usually within the police department or the fire department, for example, and that person will take the lead in seeking grant money for emergency preparedness. And they use that grant money for things like purchasing preparedness supplies or to run mock exercises or drills for preparedness. And they also conduct their regular meetings where they discuss, you know, how much money they have from these grants, how they want to get more money, how their logistics are going. They discuss their mock drills and all that stuff. They just generally prepare, and they're like the go-to guy. And so emergency preparedness really begins with the grant money. And local governments have been learning and responding to this chain of command of where the money comes from for decades. And so that's at the local level. And if you go all the way up to where at the national level or the, you know, the top state levels, you find that it also focuses on these grants, on where the money comes from, and also on these model rules, these model laws that are meant to harmonize the nation's emergency preparedness efforts, so that the nation and any individual government is prepared to respond to the given threat, whether, again, it's bioterrorism or natural disaster. And so looking at that, let's take an example. So, like, following Hurricane Katrina, which, of course, was in 2005, Congress provided $2 billion in relief, and that covered the state's share of Medicaid costs for disaster area evacuees and also people still living there. And then also some expenses to help restore access to care in the affected areas. And then, again, with the 2009 H1N1, they called it the flu pandemic, Congress provided money to do things like finance the cost of buying vaccines and drugs and medical supplies. And so this is another thing that you see in the emergency preparedness arena. You find these massive institutions like the federal government partnering with other very large organizations like local governments or with there's public-private partnerships where they will buy in large quantity these medical supplies and drugs, and they've been doing this they have to have a legal apparatus to do that. So they'll create something like the Strategic National Stockpile, and they'll fund this program the Strategic National Stockpile is a program that's administered by the CDC, and they stockpile and they deliver to the states a variety of medical products in the event that some incident somehow depletes local supplies. So they stockpile, they'll stockpile things like the anthrax vaccine. And the reason that they'll stockpile the anthrax vaccine is because it's not really available commercially, whereas at a state level, you will have many other vaccines, like flu vaccines will be more stockpiled already by states. So this is like a supplement to the state level. And, okay, so that's sort of the background of what I wanted to talk about for emergency preparedness. And
can I jump in here with a question or two, Greg?
Sure.
How much does where do these grants come from, and do they come with strings attached? And how much of the stockpiling is rational, and how much of it is political? Because somebody's in a position to make it happen and profit from it or whatever. Because, I've heard stories about Tamiflu comes to mind just as one example, where enormous amounts of money were spent buying Tamiflu. For example, the federal government spent money buying Tamiflu for the bird flu pandemic that never materialized, that kind of thing. And how much of that kind of thing is just a miscalculation versus somebody just taking advantage of their political power to profit from a situation and so forth? Any comments on
that? Great question. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the federal government has a long history of partnering with private companies to purchase the private company's products, whether they're buying, planes from Boeing or whether they're buying engineering services from Bechtel, or whether they're buying drugs from Bayer. And we find the same thing going on at the federal level with these grants. That these grants, I gather that they're run by point people. Like, there will be, some think tank out in BC, and they'll put together a plan to solicit funds, and they'll line up the contracts as well. Say, well, look, here's a threat that we perceive. Here's a flu threat, and here's a solution. Here's a vaccine that we would propose as being our preferred solution. And then they will, they'll just push it through. They'll try to gather consensus on Capitol Hill. There'll be meetings and lunches and all that stuff. If they get it going, and if they get it through, then, lo and behold, a bunch of flu vaccines are put into the stockpile. And if something looks like it's just this big cash cow that's not producing, then what they'll do is they'll make new programs and they'll change the name of it and stuff like that. So what you have is the result is, I'll quote here, this is Sarah Lister's Congressional Research Service memo from 2011, where she's saying, the respective roles and responsibilities of HHS, which provides technical expertise for state TCP programs through SAM HSAA, FEMA, and states and their contractors, which implement them, are not always clear. And so that's the greater point, is that over the course of decades, we've had this massive buildup of different alphabet, agencies that are administering these public health laws and many of these different laws. And it's almost a little bit funny. I was just pulling up this, reading this document this morning called Selected Federal Authorities Pertinent to Public Health Emergencies from September 2009, put out by the CDC. And it just goes and talks about, after 2011, after 2001, the terrorist attacks at the in New York, there's just this list of public health laws and their interpretation. And what you find is that it looks like the government doesn't even know who has these responsibilities, which is why they spent the last decade essentially running these drills and exercises and trying to figure out the funding and the chain of command. And so they're really starting to get it together, I think. And to determine, number one, who has the legal authority? Well, actually, no. Number one is, where's the funding coming from? Number two is, where into what organization does that funding go? Number three is, who has the authority to spend those funds? Number four would be, and then what are those funds supposed to be spent on? And then number five, you know, finally after all that, then you start to get into the logistics of you know, the boots on the ground. You know, what is the money buying? Who administers this stuff? What's the response time? And then we look at examples. So over the last decade, we've also had many examples where these things have been fleshed out. We've seen it working on the ground, where you have, you have these disasters, like I said, Katrina, you know, and there was the $2 billion appropriation, and it happened, you know, significantly after the fact. It wasn't like a disaster happened and then funds went out immediately. In fact, that was a big media debacle, or a media circus, you know, where people were saying, well, why isn't the relief coming? What was there, you know, some failure in the chain of command? And so in this document that I was looking at this morning, it really highlights that. You know, point to any given emergency, and I could pull up four or five different federal laws that might cover it, and different funding sources and different chains of authority. And, you know, how this all plays out on the ground is that the government officials, they rely on these fact sheets. Now, a fact sheet is like a two-page document, and it says who has the authority and what their responsibilities are. And these documents are basically summaries of law. They're like, it's even shorter than a memorandum of law. And so it's all this chain of command. There's a patchwork of chain of command documents that will highlight where these funds go and where the authority rests. Now, okay, so that's the background. You know, that's the really complex net, the background for what matters to the common man. The common man wants to know, if there is an emergency, is someone going to knock on my door and stick a needle in me? You know, or am I going to be taken away to some camp or something like that? You know, how does this affect me? And so what I did is I looked for laws that might claim that authority, that might authorize that sort of thing. What I found isn't great. What I found is that there is a section of federal law that relates to the regulations to control communicable diseases, and there are penalties for violation of quarantine laws. And this is at 42 U.S.C. Section 264, and it says that there are regulations to control communicable diseases, and among those regulations, it allows the Surgeon General to issue regulations with regard to communicable diseases and to apprehend persons reasonably believed to be infected. So this is, again, a federal law. And then the penalty, and then so basically they could take you into quarantine if they believe that you're infected. And the penalty for this is, if you violate a quarantine law or somehow try to dodge this, is a crime. So now what we see is that if you are, let's say you are a peaceful and natural person, you know, you're wearing your moccasins, you're drinking your herbal tea that you grew on your own land, for example, and a federal official shows up and they say, well, we want to test you to make sure that you don't have, you know, the new strain of tuberculosis, let's say, or smallpox. You say, well, I feel that's a violation of my right to bodily integrity. I have the right to be peacefully natural. I'm on my own private land. I'm not, you know, entering a public hospital or going into a, you know, a public courthouse or anything like that. Just peacefully here. Well, these rules that are set forth at federal law don't deal with that type of situation. It's just this blanket one-size-fits-all discretion to authorities that so they can push as strong as they want. There's sort of this hope that they wouldn't go that far. You know, they wouldn't try to you know, push too hard, that there's a reasonableness put in there. And so and another thing that I left out earlier is that this federal law only applies, the federal government only has the authority to implement this measure, sort of it's a jurisdictional thing, when the person is crossing state lines. You see, because if states themselves, like the state of California, for example, that has the authority to govern public health matters within its jurisdiction. And the only time that the federal government is supposed to step in is when someone is crossing state lines, or if there's a if it's a national border issue, or if it's a like a national threat issue, you know, like a bioterrorist attack, something like that, or if there's a an agreement, like a public, if there's a an agreement between the federal government and the state governments to have some type of sharing or cooperative responsibility. And those are getting very common today, by the way. We actually talked about that in the in a previous show. And so the other point I want to raise is that the federal government, there's also a law that I read, I forget whether it's a regulation or a statute, but it says that if the if a state government or a state or a local government, any government at the state level or local level, fails to control an infectious disease, then the federal government has the power to step in and control it for them. So that's another example. So if you had let's say you had a county, for example, that had a sheriff, you know, and he was like, I'm kicking the feds out of town, you know, and then in those isolated incidences, the federal government could come in and say that, you know, here you have law enforcement who's not doing their duty to control infectious disease. We're going to step in and take over the chain of command here. So,
who gets to decide if the local government is failing to do their job? Is that a federal discretionary call, do you think?
Yeah, it's according to – I just pulled it up here. It's Part 70. Okay, so you go to Title 42 of the CFR, Part 70. It's called Interstate Quarantine. And it's the discretion is given to the director of the CDC, and he determines whether there is what's quote unquote inadequate local control. So he just has to determine if they if the measures taken by health authorities are quote insufficient to prevent the spread of any of the communicable diseases from such state or possession to any other state or possession. Close quote. So, you know, it's incredibly vague. And that again is in a regulation. So regulations are supposed to be more specific than the underlying authorizing statute. But here you have a vague statement. And this is another thing that I wanted to bring up for our topic. Okay. In the history of America, we've had very broad rules when it comes to our emergency preparedness. And part of the reason why is because it's hard to prepare for an emergency. You don't really know what's going to happen. And so you want your people on the ground to have discretion to handle it as they see fit. So what we will do is we'll draft these laws that are broad enough to cover any given circumstance and just hope against hope, that the authorities in place will use them wisely. And what we've seen in the history of looking at quarantines is that they aren't used wisely. You have things like in San Francisco in the 1800s, in 1885, Yick Woe v. Hopkins, where a local law was applied to that was Chinese laundries. I'm actually thinking of the early 20th century, the rounding up of Chinese immigrants and putting them all into these camps, and it just spread communicable diseases, and they thought that they were containing them. It was just this terrible policy, and it was ultimately overruled by courts, but it still happened. And so the history of our country shows that these public health authorities tend to have a sort of a one-track mind, you know, where they're implementing their regulations, and that's all that they're looking at. And they're hoping that there's something and society basically needs something to keep that in check, you know, some other advocate coming in from the other side saying, you know, look, public health authorities, these are the limits that you have on your authority. Now, in our age, to put those things in check, we require, you know, an effective attorney base of, you know, civil rights lawyers who are keeping this in check, and independent and free media that is, you know, keeping this in check, and then also an intelligent populace. Okay. Now, so So let's look at that. I haven't looked at the percentage of civil rights lawyers compared to the percentage of the population. You know, that'd be one thing to look at. I have looked at our media. You know, do we have an honest and free open media? You know, that's debatable. And then much of it is online these days. You know, very few people get newspapers in terms of, you know, the percentage of the population compared to the past. And then, you know, in the event of a real emergency, you know, what is going to be the access to information? And so that's actually a good segue for us to talk about the next phase. So let's say that you are one of the individuals who gets swept up by one of these systems, whether it's at the state level or it's at the federal level. And so, you know, somebody did come and knock on your door, and they were wearing a badge, and they said, well, we're here to test you. And you said no. And they said, okay, well, you can come with us because we're going to put you in a quarantine. Okay. Now, in that case, what you have to do is hopefully call an attorney. But there are procedures that are set out in these model laws. And these model laws will say, you know, how much due process you get, you know, how much procedural due process do you get a hearing, and as part of that hearing, you know, do you get to present, you know, your own evidence? You get to subpoena witnesses. You get to call a doctor and stuff like that. Can you be quarantined without a hearing? You know, and if so, for how long? 24 hours is the answer, according to one of these model laws. So let me give a little background about what a model health law is and how they come about today. Okay, so the first model act for emergency preparedness that I'm going to be talking about today is called the MSEHPA, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And this was this act was drafted by the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, and they're it's a federally funded project with military ties. And essentially it was presented for publication in March of 2001, but then it wasn't published until right after the 9/11 attack. And this model legislation was very, very ill-received by the public. The public did not like it. And it basically forced any individuals suspected of harboring an infectious disease to undergo medical examination, tracked and shared personal health information, including genetic information, forced people to be vaccinated, treated, quarantined, mandated all healthcare providers to report cases of people harboring illness, forcing pharmacists to report unusual prescriptions, things like that, mobilizing the militia, rationing firearms, explosives, rationing alcoholic beverages, including that. And so so when this came out in September of 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks, citizens across the country who were paying attention were very concerned. And the American Legislative Exchange Council and other groups were tracking it and reporting to people on how this affected individual freedoms and property rights. That one group happens to focus on property rights in particular. And the groups that really raised a big stink about it were the gun activists, and they were some of the most influential opponents. And so in response to all that bad press, this model law was revised. It was revised in December, so only about 2 months later. What's kind of funny about it is that, and funny in a bad way, is that the law itself wasn't changed. They just changed the wording, the rhetoric. So instead of controlling persons, they used the word controlling persons for a public health emergency. They changed it to protecting persons. Instead of controlling private property, they changed it to manage private property. And then instead of saying that they were going to ration firearms, they just used the word commodities, so that it's unclear. And the idea was, you know, how can they get these gun people off the backs of this law, of this proposed law? And so then this all came out, you know, in December, and then there was this organization that was tracking called Turning Point, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They were tracking the tracking the legislation in the states, you know, seeing how many provisions were enacted. But the states really weren't enacting this thing because they just because there was so much opposition. You know, there's this idea that there is this very small group of people in America who are very well connected within universities and military circles, and they are drafting these proposed laws that don't represent the interests of Americans and don't represent the interests of state citizens, because they are they're taking away liberties and giving great power during emergency to these officials who realistically can't be trusted. Well, why can't they be trusted? Because they're doing things like stockpiling drugs, giving massive checks to the pharmaceutical industry and stuff like that. It's not it's not smart policy. And although that stuff goes on, you know, at an incredible level, it's hard to enact that stuff at the state level. It's easier to enact it at the federal level because, you know, as they say, Washington's corrupt. So following this this law and tracking it through, we come to the year 2006 when this organization funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Turning Point, was sort of disbands. And that's kind of where it was left off. So we have this incomplete patchwork of emergency preparedness laws that sort of vaguely give powers to the federal government, to state governments, to do things like quarantine individuals and test individuals for infectious diseases. And all the same, there's also a massive body of law that protects your right to be peacefully natural, protects your right to bodily integrity, says that you can't be searched and seized without a warrant and stuff like that. So you can see there's two different bodies of law that are going head to head. And on one side we have, American history, the Supreme Court saying, you know, you have all these rights to bodily integrity and freedom. And then on the other side you have this very small group of militaristic individuals who are pushing these little laws, and they just keep inching a little bit forward. And after every disaster, like with 9/11, like with Katrina, they get just a little bit closer, you know, and they get and so these laws are wiggling in, and they're untested. So we're basically just looking at, you know, what is likely to happen in the event of a major emergency. And so one thing that I'm finding is that, and we talked about this in our last show, that the best policy when dealing with something that's untested is to try to not have it tested on you. So, for example, you know that the federal government has, because I just read it to you, has some plausible authority to quarantine individuals, or at least that's what they're claiming, in the event, if you cross state lines. So in the event of an emergency, don't cross state lines. Try to stick where you are. And to the extent that you can take proactive measures with regard to your health and staying out of the public square and stuff like that, you know, it can really go a long way to avoid being tested by this system. And historically, that was the case as well, because when we look at other major national disasters, public health authorities are trying to basically implement their regulations, implement their powers across only a certain percentage of the population. They know they can't get 100% of all people to come and, you know, get tested and do all this. They're really just trying to go for, you know, a threshold to meet their goals, whether it's 90% or 80%. There's always going to be certain people who, you know, run for the hills. And I don't say that, like, these are just hillbillies running for the hills. You know, when we look at, we talked about this last show. You know, in the case of New York, it was actually the rich people who were running from the hills, from these public health authorities, because they knew what was happening. And so my experience with these local authorities is that they it's much easier to be to interface with a local authority than it would be with a federal authority. There's a better responsiveness and so forth. So did you guys want to chime in on that?
Well, I got a question here. Greg, I read an article recently talking about a student who was vaccinated with swine flu at school, and I don't know if there was just a miscommunication or what, but the bottom line is it was without the parents' consent and over the parents' objection. And it ended up in court recently, and the decision from the court was that there was not a case, the parent did not have a case, because there was a nationally declared emergency at that time. And I think what they were saying was that the federal law, the Pandemic Preparedness Act, I presume, would trump any state law right. I'm a little inarticulate here because I don't have the clarity in my own mind of the exact laws involved. But ultimately, the court said, threw the case out, that the mother had no recourse for suing the school or the state or anyone, and ultimately it was because of the superseding federal law and the declared state of emergency. Now, one of the things I am often talking to people about, clients or others, is the idea that, you know, in my work I have a substantial focus on exemptions and waivers. But most of those laws, most of the time, we're dealing with routine immunizations. And I tell people when there's a state of emergency declared, and if there is also, pursuant to that state of emergency, an emergency vaccine ordered, the laws in most states, certainly the ones that I've seen with perhaps the exception of Minnesota, the immunizations that apply, I mean, the exemptions and waivers that apply to routine immunizations go out the window. But this case that I was just talking about sort of seemed to me like it took this to a whole different level, where you're saying because of the nationally declared emergency, the school could not be faulted for vaccinating a child without the parents' consent. Any thoughts or comments about that and
sure,
how that
sure.
does or doesn't fit into, you know, what you've just been talking about?
Is that the Parker case from New York? Is that the one we're talking about?
That may be. I'm sorry, I don't have it on the tip of my tongue here.
In that case, I looked at that case, and what I found is that the first off, it was a New York case, and the school district was called into court as the defendant. And so the child was in public school, and the mother was alleging negligence, basically that the school had vaccinated the child, presumably by accident because of the negligence allegation, by failing to notice the lack of consent form. So, the appealing question was that it was a tort case, so the mother was suing the government for money. And so there was no issue about other legal or practical procedures. So, like there was no issue as to whether the government can force vaccination. The issue was, can this mother sue the government for money for a negligent act with regard to vaccines? And what and she was trying to go into state court, and the case was dismissed on jurisdiction grounds because the appeals court said it should have been filed in federal court. So the case could still go forward if refiled in federal court. And also, this highlights the practical considerations. You know, if you choose to put your child in public school and the school notifies you that a vaccination day is coming, don't let your kid go to school that day, you know. And don't rely on just the consent form. You know, these are individuals who are just churning these kids, you know, and they might miss your form. They might not notice your lack of consent form. So keep your kid home that day. that would be the best course.
Yeah, it's sad, though, but it sort of goes to this sort of more general principle that if the issue is really, really important to you, then take all reasonable steps possible to deal with it. You know, I have a lot of people come to me after they've been rejected, and the vast majority of the time when that occurs, the reason they were rejected was because they put something in their religious belief statement opposed to vaccines that I tell all my clients, don't ever put this in your statement. And I'm saying that not intending any criticism, certainly on any personal level, with any of these people when they come to me. These people have all done very reasonable things in terms of putting together their own statement of beliefs. It's just that the law is trickier than most people understand, and probably most of the time. There are, I guess, some legal issues that are pretty clear and straightforward, but non-attorneys, and the same would apply, I'm sure, to other professions as well, but in the case of law, a lot of non-attorneys are disadvantaged in the sense that, with regard to what I sometimes refer to as the what you don't know that you don't know syndrome. So people will make what seems to them a very reasonable decision given the information they have, but there are things they don't know about that if they did know about, they wouldn't be, they'd make a different decision, a different choice. Now, we should be able to rely on school officials, health authorities, and so forth. And so if somebody sends in a form saying, I don't consent to the vaccine, they ought to be able to rely on the school to do that. But I think you have to ask yourself, how important is this issue? If the odds of a mistake might be, who knows, 1 in 10,000 or whatever, but mistakes happen. And if getting a vaccine is just absolutely not acceptable, then I agree with you completely. Just don't send your child to school that day. But, you know, if it's not that big of a deal, if it gets messed up, then send in the form and who cares what happens, you know. So everybody, of course, has to decide what issues are really important and how important they are. But I tell you, as the general rule, and, you know, easy for me to say this as a lawyer, I guess, but if it's a legal issue or an issue with legal components or ramifications, and if it's important, go see a lawyer up front. You know, lawyers make a lot of money trying to bail people out of situations that they could have avoided altogether if they just done a simple consultation up front with an attorney. So I may be getting a little bit off the topic here, but it's really important, you know, in vaccine issues in particular. For the people who are concerned about vaccines tend to be very concerned. You know, I haven't met or talked with very many people who were sort of, you know, I think once I've talked to a healthcare worker who said, how do I avoid the vaccine? I gave my little spiel. She says, what do you charge? I told her what I charge, and she says, I guess I'll go get the shot. You know, for her, spending the money. And I'm pretty inexpensive as attorneys go, frankly. But still, it's a significant sum for a lot of people, and for some people, it's just not worth it. And I might personally disagree, and certainly many of my clients would disagree, but everybody has to make those decisions for themselves, of course. And I fully respect anybody's decision. But I certainly hope that people, when they're making vaccine decisions, that they strive to be fully informed so their decisions are fully informed. And I don't blame that mother at all for not thinking, I better keep my kid out of school. But given what happened, you know, if that happens in my school, I'll probably keep my kid home, frankly.
I have a question, too. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about the right to gather and protest something. For instance, if there's something happening in your local or state area and you're concerned, your friends and neighbors are concerned about an issue, and I'm hearing the message that run for the hills, stay away, don't be in the public eye, don't be, you know, because there's cameras everywhere today, and the government or the state is taking pictures of who you are and where you are and keeping a file on you. Now, what if you want to protest? Do we have, is this not a wise choice to unify?
Yeah, I think it is. It is smart to unify and to protest these draconian regulations and also their unjust enforcement. And I can tell you from a constitutional standpoint that the government, the Supreme Court has upheld the right of the government to place reasonable, quote, time, place, and manner restrictions on assemblies. So, and as long as those restrictions on time, place, and manner are applied equally across the board, then it's upheld constitutionally. So, for example, your city, your local city, and say that if you all want to gather, you know, in a particular public place, the time, place, and manner restriction is, you know, it can't be at 1 a.m., you know. It has to be, you know, sometime during the day. The place has to be acceptable for your gathering, so you can't have, you know, 10,000 people all in one house. It's unsanitary. And the time, place, and then the manner would be that, you know, it'd be things like, you know, can you give us notice so we can make sure that we have, you know, some police officers there to ensure crowd control and stuff like that. So in the event that you had a declared emergency and an infectious disease issue or something like that, then the what would be quote unquote reasonable might be, you know, actually greater time, place, and manner restrictions. So it would be harder to have a gathering, but it doesn't mean that you couldn't have it. And we may have to start getting more creative with the way that we gather. Like, for example, through online petitions is one way to gather without actually putting our physical bodies into the public square, although often it's not as effective. And so although we do have these traditional rights, there's a smart way to do it that can get lost.
Right. So we have to think of ways that we can voice as a community our concerns for people knocking on our door, giving us a vaccination without giving us time to consider what to do or get a lawyer or take us away and quarantine us because they have declared an emergency, they have declared this is a pandemic. And so when there's a pandemic, that means that contagion, they're afraid of the spread of this disease. And so in order to protect it, they want to isolate people. Now, if we want to protest this, let's say this is, you know, back in, 2009, there was a declared pandemic, but it really wasn't. And even today, every single message that I see is the best way of protecting yourself against influenza is by getting the vaccine. And in the very same paragraph, they will say it is only 50 to 70% effective and it will not protect everybody. And so this is a very confusing message. How does the public protect themselves besides running to the hills?
Well, we need a holistic approach. Just as we need a holistic approach to medicine, we need a holistic approach to society. And running away from a problem is not really a holistic way to address a problem, but there is a smart way to do it. So, like, you know, if faced with the government authorities who are absolutely determined to arrest you, and put you in quarantine, you just have to make a choice. You know, you have to decide, am I the type of person who wants to, you know, get my friend to get this on YouTube and let's go do this. You know, it's our time. I'm ready.
Okay.
You know, or are you the person who says, no, I have four kids and we are going to stick it out here on the ranch and
mm-hmm.
our natural remedies. So, you know, we are a diverse community and we are connected. And I think probably the answer is that, you know, we just hope that, you know, the guy who wants to get it on YouTube is able to connect with the lady who wants to stick it out with her four kids on the ranch, and that somehow they end up helping each other. You know, that's mutually beneficial. You know, while the one is hauled off to quarantine, the lady on the ranch is using every power that she has in terms of legislative activism, getting on the internet and talking about it, and just working together to promote holistically the answer that we want. Because right now, as I wrote in my memo in 2010, and as I showed today through the National Strategic Stockpile, right now the policy of the United States government is to stockpile drugs and medical equipment, and I think they intend to use it.
I have one more, I think, important comment. I am concerned about being able to have access to the internet. I feel that at the switch of a button, it can be turned off. I mean, it may be paranoid. I mean, you know, it's not something that I think about every day. It's just something that I know can happen based on the past experience of the last couple of years, you know, when all of the websites shut down in protest of government authority over the internet access. What do you say to that?
Yes, yes. There was a major outcry over SOPA.
Yes,
and,
SOPA.
Yeah, and it showed that even very institutional sources, you know, people that are tied into the system, like Wikipedia, it's very, very institutional, are opposed to this and are willing to put their foot down. And whenever something comes out that looks like SOPA, again, which will surely happen, they will resist it. Now, this ebb and flow to rights and powers also comes in context today with threats. So if there is some virus that hits the internet and people feel like it is better to be protected, to have a greater regulation of the internet, then otherwise they might lose the internet altogether. You know, if there's just a lack of confidence in visiting websites and stuff like that, then I think people would start to support greater regulations.
Right.
Now the debate is over. The ability of the government to shut down entire websites. So, like in the past, there was this. There's always been a consensus that the government has the power to shut down things that are like, a court can issue an order saying, you know, you can't, slander somebody. You know, if there's a slander case and you lose a slander case, they can issue an order and you have to remove the offending content, or you can't steal someone's copyright, you know, and so they can remove the offending copyright, you may have to pay damages. But then there was SOPA and its progeny, and that elevated it. Then it was the government's sort of blanket authority to just shut down entire websites, to just remove from public scrutiny entire people, entire organizations, as almost as if they didn't exist or weren't allowed to connect with others. And so it was, and that's where I think the debate still remains today. And so when I analyze the issue, I think what terrorist attack would create some virus which would swing the debate where people said, yeah, we actually want the government to protect us from entire categories of people. We want the government to determine when to shut down entire websites. And if somebody doesn't get the stamp of approval, you know, the mark of approval, then they're off. And the infrastructure is already set up to accomplish that. And it's a system of keys. And you would have to have a key, you know, your own encryption key to be able to get through. And the way that encryption works today is that it's not just a series of code that can be like one block of code that can be hacked. What it is now is it's constantly changing code. So like essentially what you need is an algorithm that is constantly changing this back-end code so it's never static, and therefore it can't be hacked, because something static can be examined and hacked. And so that software, you know, if the government came out and said that there needs to be a way to harmonize the software, we need to regulate the software, and in order to access it, you know, in order to be part of our encryption program, you have to get your key, you know, and who gets the key, you know? It's the gatekeeper.
This is really frightening. Yeah, so that means that the people of America have to be vigilant and educated. One of the key points that you said at the beginning of the show, an educated populace, was one of the top things. And so that's the importance of this show and having it available and archived for future listening to anybody who wants to find out about it. We need people to tell others to share. If you're out there listening, this is a really key and important show. We have about 5 minutes, so finish up and tell us whatever it is that you need to your major message, and when you'll be back.
Sure. Yeah.
Can I
do is too
Greg,
close.
Greg, can I slip in a quick question here? Or
yeah, sure.
I saw something actually just in the last day or so that was very disturbing to me, and I don't have the details. And if you're not familiar with it, we can come back to it in a future show. But apparently, legislation has passed recently that gives Obama a domestic army. Are you familiar with that?
No, it's an executive order.
I didn't catch the full story, so I wasn't real clear. I know there have been some executive orders entered, but I believe it was legislation. But the discussion, I'll send you the information I have on it, and maybe we can come back to it. But it was sort of disturbing because it was unclear what it was for and what the limitation of its power were. So let's come back to that then, and I'll pass the baton back to you then to summarize or wrap up for us today.
I'll read two quotes, one from the United States Supreme Court and one from the California Supreme Court. They're both short. And then I'll pass a question to you guys. And the question is going to be, is it okay, is it lawful for the government to arrest? Okay. Here we go. First quote. This is from the United States Supreme Court. Quote, no right is held more sacred or is more carefully guarded by the common law than the right of every individual to the possession and control of his own person, free from all restraint or interference of others, unless by clear and unquestionable authority of law. And the same Supreme Court says, quote, there is, of course, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human government, especially of any free government existing under a written constitution, to interfere with the exercise of that will. And then I'm going to read quickly a quote from the California Supreme Court. Okay. The relatively certain principle that a competent adult has the right to refuse medical treatment, even treatment necessary to sustain life. Close quote. Okay, so my question to you guys is,
can you repeat the last Supreme Court from California,
sure,
what it said?
Yeah. This is from Conservatorship of Wendland, 2001, California Supreme Court. The starting point of the analysis is the, quote, relatively certain principle that a competent adult has the right to refuse medical treatment, even treatment necessary to sustain life, close quote. Okay. So my question to you guys is, if there is a peaceful individual who is residing on their private property, does the United States government or any state government have the authority to knock on that person's door and then take them against their will, forcefully give them a medical test, and possibly force medical treatment? And if this person refuses, is it okay to charge them with a crime? What do you think?
You start first, Alan.
Well, based on the quotes you just read, it certainly seems not. But this raises a prospect that we've talked about in recent legislation passed by several states just in the last couple of years. Five different states have passed laws restricting access to exemptions for parents and kids in school. And at least three of those laws, in my opinion, violate constitutional provisions. And we appear to be living in a time when state and federal governments are, to one degree or another, throwing the Constitution to the wind and just implementing laws that serve, in many instances, private agendas. And as all too common, a bill gets passed before Congress or passed into law by Congress about some particular issue, and there'll be some other things slid in there that have nothing to do with the issue and things that Congress never read or debated or anything, but it gets attached to a bill and gets passed anyway. And that's a little trick whereby individual representatives can serve their own or their constituents or their buddies' private agendas. So it seems really, really disturbing to me. I'm delighted to hear the Supreme Court passages, would love sites for those, but it doesn't sound to me like that's entirely consistent with what I was hearing you saying nearer the top of the hour about the emergency powers.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, it negates everything when you declare the pandemic emergency. Then the government, the federal government, takes over whatever those state rights were. And you know what? I also think you may know these rights, you may learn about them, but sometimes actions take place before you can protect yourself, I would say. You know, like what you do, Alan, you have to fix a damage that's already been done. So once the damage has been done, you might go in and start to look more carefully at these laws, but you know what I'm saying on that?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody comes to your door and says they're going to take you away, if you say, no, the Constitution doesn't allow you to do that, here's the Supreme Court case that says it, the person at the door is going to say, tell it to the judge, you're coming
right
with me. And if you even have the option of telling it to the judge, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, this is not a court that, you know, you don't have, that's not the place where you can make that argument. Unfortunately. I mean, hopefully the person at the door will listen to you and agree with you, but they certainly are far more likely to say, here's what the law says, here are my orders, I'm just following orders, sorry, you got to go. The order didn't say anything about unless they had a good excuse, you know. So you're kind of stuck with how these things play out, and it's very, very disturbing, the implications. And if the domestic army thing is what it initially looks like to me, Obama's got a force for enforcing some of these unconstitutional laws that are being passed. You know, indefinite detention, I can't believe. Somebody tried to fix that law at least a little bit, saying, except Americans on American soil, but that got taken back out before the bill was signed into law. So the indefinite detention without a lawyer, according to the sources I'm hearing from, is on the books now. Blatantly unconstitutional, but it's there. And what disturbs me most about that one, if somebody detains you, they're decided that you're a terrorist suspect for whatever reason or no reason, and you're detained. If you don't have access to a lawyer or the courts, you don't even get to argue that the law is unconstitutional. You know, at least if somebody decides they want to quarantine you, there's probably an opportunity somewhere in that arena to get a hearing and present your case. Hey, this is unconstitutional, and here are the cases that say it. And then hopefully the judge in that kind of situation would agree with you and let you go back home. But anyway, Greg,
okay.
Incredibly informative today, just amazingly well-researched, and we gave you time to talk more than we do a lot in the past, that you have, I'm sure, have been equally prepared and not as able because we got into more sidelines and questions. So I just really appreciate the incredible preparedness with which you come to your monthly shows with us, and just delighted to have you as always.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I really like the format today. And we are going to continue. After we close today's show, which we're a little bit over, I'm going to have another guest call in, Phyllis Georgic, getting well naturally. I think you'd like it. She's a very good and old friend of mine. And she is, I believe, in Pennsylvania, a holistic practitioner who is a homeopath. And for those folks who want to call in, we have the number 347-945-6956, or click the blue Skype button and we'll listen to your comment or question. Greg, tell us when you're going to be back, and you'll inform us about whether we're continuing the same discussion or moving on to something else.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a lot more to talk about on this particular topic, and we should continue it. I'll plan on being back on a Thursday in February.
Great. Okay, we're looking forward to it. It's a short month.
Thanks so much, Debbie.
Okay, bye-bye. And thank you, Alan, so much. People, are knocking down your door to get your help. And you can find Alan at pandemicresponseproject.com and vaccinerights.com. He is in North Carolina and takes clients from all over the United States, right?
That's correct. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
You too, Debbie.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone. Now we're going to have Phyllis I see she's in the chat, so she basically just needs to call in to 347-945-6956 or click the Skype button. Alternatively, I may be able to call into her. So I'm going to put on a little bit of music while we get her on the line. Hold on.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Phyllis can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message.
We're back, and you are just listening to Alan Phillips, the musician in him. He's a composer, an instrumentalist, and a lyricist, and a singer. So we love to hear his voice about freedom. And Phyllis, I understand that you were listening to the entire first half of today's show with Greg Glaser and Alan Phillips.
I was listening to a good portion of it. I was still doing some work around the house here while I was listening.
Okay, so that's great. So folks who do listen in, you can do it at your leisure. We've got all of the shows archived. There's many hundreds of shows, over 3 years worth, and the series with Alan and Greg. You can download it to your mobile device. You can download it on iTunes or upload it on iTunes, and you can get it streaming so that you can listen at your leisure, whether you're in the car or vacuuming the house or cleaning up the dishes. So,
like Phyllis was doing.
And today, I believe you said you wanted to talk about influenza. If you have any comments about this issue of quarantine and legal rights, I welcome to entertain any of those types of questions as well.
Well, basically, you know what I was listening, and I caught on pieces of things here and there. And what I noticed was you were talking about pandemics and how they claim that there's some pandemic, but they, you know, like for instance, I sent out an email the other day. I don't know if you noticed it about Vermont claiming that there's a worldwide pandemic of whooping cough, and they cite 612 cases.
Okay.
Now, to me, pandemic is like hundreds of thousands.
Uh-huh.
It certainly isn't 612. And it does state in the article that 90% or 80% of the children who had the whooping cough were children who were completely vaccinated. So we're recognizing that pandemics are actually, quote-unquote, their pandemics or their definition of pandemics are actually being orchestrated by them.
Exactly. The definition of pandemic has definitely changed. And if you think that the whooping cough has been constrained to certain local regions and is not worldwide. We'd have to take a look at the map. I have not prepared that information for today's show, but in the future we could certainly look at that.
Right. And I just wanted to bring that point up about the fact of what is a pandemic and who is the one who equates, you know, like what body of authority has the right to equate what is a pandemic and who has the right to say, well, it's now time for us to come into your neighborhood, into your community, and call people to action. They must come here to get their vaccines.
Right.
Or if they don't come, then we want a written letter or a written group of residents of this community who have not shown up today or yesterday or last week or whenever we had the other campaign. So this is the problem. The problem lies with the fact is the authority is going to, if the authority, if this is, and this is just a scenario, comes to your door and says, we have tuberculosis in the area and we want to check to see if you have tuberculosis, how in your equation could what their test be a real test or be something that they're injecting in you for this test? Or are they taking you to a location where you will be exposed to radiation, to some other disease? How do you know that the information that they return to you is going to be honest information? We don't know any of this.
Absolutely. And
this is what we have come into as a world of people who have recognized that there's far too much that corporations have as far as grants go involving themselves with the government. So government grants are big time. I mean, that one guy that would get on TV and do a little commercial with all the question marks on his clothes and would have this big, huge, thick book telling you all these government grants you can access from this book that he wants to sell you for $75 or whatever. There are a lot of grants, and so it just depends on what anybody cares to do in an area and what they want to do as far as getting money. And this money, where's this money coming from? That's your tax dollars.
Yeah.
You know, your tax dollars are going for all these grants. Every grant that makes every grant that's asked for by a university to study some disease so that they can make a vaccination for it comes to a pharmaceutical company. That pharmaceutical company, once they make that vaccine, becomes their property.
Mm-hmm.
And they pass it on to you, the public, and they have to sell it because, of course, you're not going to buy a car from Ford if Toyota's making a car that's better or giving you a better line, at least, to telling you that it's better.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people are out there. You know, if they don't want to vaccinate their children, like he was making the comment that this child was accidentally vaccinated, I don't believe that for one moment.
Well,
whose parent does not want him vaccinated, does not send him to school during the vaccine campaign, or has not been notified that there's a vaccine campaign, or, you know, there are so many stopgaps. This child, a parent who doesn't vaccinate their children, the child knows he's not being or she's not being vaccinated and that she's against vaccines and that mommy and daddy are against vaccines. This child is not going to go and get themselves stuck with the needle when mommy and daddy are against it. And they
right.
would voice that opinion. So there would be stop gaps made. I don't believe any of this. There was some sort of, in the middle of the state in Pennsylvania and near Hershey, Pennsylvania, a woman who is intending to have a home birth went into an emergency labor, and she called her midwife. Her midwife told her to call the EMT, and they took her to Hershey Medical Center. Well, I'm sure upon this, they asked her, well, who's your doctor? She says, I was going to have a home birth. The baby was born fine, and they, at some point or another, got Children and Youth Services in there to take the baby away from her so that they could vaccinate it with the hepatitis B vaccine and allowed the mother and put the mother out onto the street and allowed the mother to come back every 3 hours to nurse the child.
Now, is this a true story?
This is a true story. This is a true story, yes.
Okay, so we could find out the story on the Internet in the news?
Right, and I did, and I sent out an email to it, and I sent out the the piece to it. And when I had mentioned it to my daughter-in-law, who does home birth her children, she said, yes, I noted that, and it was on my Facebook or something like this. She said, I put it on my Facebook. So,
right. So
when I got it, it was actually old news, several months old.
Right. So there's a whole conglomeration of different thoughts about protecting yourself, about being able to protect yourself in these campaigns. And when you talk about stop gaps, I think there are not only places along the way that steps can be taken, but places along the way that mistakes can be made. And I'm thinking, like Greg, he likes to give a little bit of historical background to say what has happened in America. And you just think about Ellis Island, or the when the Chinese or the Oriental people were taken away to camps in America at different times in history.
The Second World War, yes.
Yeah, that you see images of these individuals being sprayed down
right.
with chemicals
right.
and going through all. And today, what would happen? We would be X-rayed like crazy. We would probably have radiation ionizing rays. Who knows what kind of checks they would do on us and what kind of chemicals or injections they would give, supposedly for the public good, for the protection of the community, and for the betterment of that individual without their consent. Things happen so quickly in life that you don't always have a chance to stop the action from occurring. But, you know, do you want to continue this line of talking today, or do you want to move along to influenza? Do you want to talk about this topic?
Well, I mean, this is part of the topic, but yes, we can talk about the influenza. I did send you my, I think it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago that I put together that dealing with all sorts of strains of, I can't remember what I labeled it, dealing with all strains of influenza.
Yes, it's called deal with all strains of flu with homeopathic remedies. And so yesterday I also did a show, which was very well attended, concerning the truth about influenza, collecting data and statistics. For instance, like you said, what is a pandemic? The name has the parameters of pandemic have been changed by the World Health Organization, and so it's considerably different today. And then we have the list of homeopathic remedies. I mentioned a good number of them yesterday, but we can go through them again because you have additional information.
Well, basically, I think I'm not looking at it right now, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to squirt that down and and go to my go to that article or to that document and look at it. I basically give you some real common sense information about dealing with the flu when you have it. And a lot of people think that vomiting and diarrhea go along with the influenza, and it truthfully doesn't. Influenza is basically, and I listed here, as lethargy and fever, maybe sore throat, weakness, muscle aches, runny nose, and headache.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any kind of what people call stomach flu, that really isn't a flu. That's really probably some kind of digestive tract disorder. You ate bad food. Sometimes you don't even recognize that you can eat bad food, and you know it's stayed out too long or something else has gone with it. But the Spanish flu or the Spanish epidemic in 1918 had a lot of vomiting and diarrhea in it. So that's the reason why they label that as the flu. But the flu strains that they give you the injections of don't necessarily bring about, the injections of the vaccines don't bring about nausea and vomiting. The people during the Spanish flu epidemic actually dehydrated, and most of these people died of electrolyte imbalances, so their heart stopped. and their you know, their kidneys went weak. And so as a result, that is one of the reasons why they died. Now, we know from a lot of documented information that those who went to homeopathic hospitals or had homeopathic doctors treating them actually survived quite well. And those that came to homeopathy that were even in the last stages did well. There were a few that were so bad off that passed away because they were far past help at that point. But when you have nausea and vomiting, this is probably more due to eating the wrong food. Again, the flu vaccine, but again, I list in here things like the uses of barley water. A lot of people don't even recognize what that is. I remember my mother making up barley water when my little baby sisters were infants and they had diarrhea. Now, they had diarrhea a lot because my mom fed them formula. She did not breastfeed them. So as a result, they weren't getting any antibodies. And, you know, it's real easy. I know that my mother was extremely careful when she made those bottles up. And when she sterilized them, she was, like, really on top of it. But most of the time, infant babies are very allergic to cow's milk. And that is basically what it was made from back then, is cow's milk. You didn't have a whole lot of goats, so we didn't have a whole lot of goat milk. People who lived on farms who had goats, they would feed their babies that. But most of the time, Similac, Enfamil, whatever other stuff, I can only remember those two. I breastfed my children, so I didn't even get involved in any of that. But that would often cause diarrhea. And what she would do is she would take barley, pearl barley, and put it into water and soak it in water and heat it slowly and add just a little bit of salt and a little bit of sugar to it. And it would not cook the barley. It would just make the barley water kind of cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
And this would harden up the stool.
I have a question about the barley. Is it coated with anything that we need to rinse it off first before we soak it in the water?
Well, I would do that simply because you don't know where it was stored or, you know, what kind of grain, how they put it together. You should always clean your rice or your grain.
Okay.
Or buckwheat or millet or whatever it is. You should rinse it several times in cold water and pull out anything. There could be little pieces of stone in there. If you're going to, I've known several scenarios. I'm not going to say many, but I've known several scenarios where people actually injured their teeth on eating rice because
mm-hmm.
there was a little tiny stone in there. They didn't recognize it. They didn't clean out their rice. They just put it into the crock pot or put it into the rice steamer, started to chew on it, and boom, they chewed right into a big stone. And it was tiny, but it was a big stone that hurt their teeth.
Our teeth are very sensitive to everything.
Right, especially something like rocks. We can't eat them.
No, we can't.
So, as a result, it's important to clean off everything before you use it because you don't know where it's been.
Mm-hmm.
And organically grown things are grown with organic substances that can have bacteria in them. That's what they're there for. That's why we have organic substances. They have various organisms in it to break down things. And so as a result, you could have anything in that. So it's always important to do that. I know that there's other places where I've heard of using rice water in the same way. You rinse off the rice water, clean it off, and then just slightly cook it so that it has this haze to it. And that you're not eating the rice itself. You're just drinking the water off of it. So you're not even hydrating the rice or the barley to become. You're just using that little bit of starch that's left on top of it and adding a slight bit of sugar and a slight bit of salt. And that is actually what they have taught people in third world countries, especially in Africa, when their children have diarrhea, Nicaragua, Honduras. When their children have diarrhea, this is the water that you make up to feed your baby. This is the Pedialyte that the company, I can't even remember what company makes Pedialyte. but basically right. this would be your own Pedialyte.
Okay, so how much do you give? I'm sure for a baby, it's much less. But what about an adult?
Again, it depends. You know, you can drink a cup of it. And some people who are having diarrhea and vomiting can't drink anything very much anyhow. So they're just going to take little spoonful sips.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which is, of course, the homeopathic remedy indication for arsenicum album.
Right.
So and you would give them arsenicum album, and you could give them this. You know, another good thing to use if you and I use these barley waters and things like that if I don't have the remedy, or if I'm stuck in a situation where the person that is calling me or asking me doesn't have a homeopathic remedy on hand, so I tell them to do these simple measures. Another one is to take toast, and you can take white toast, and toast it till it burns, and then scrape off all of that charcoal into some water and have the person sip on that charcoal water. That will also stop diarrhea and vomiting.
Excellent. And so that would be CarboVeg?
Correct. That's CarboVeg.
Okay, so now what's really fascinating about what you're teaching us today is that even though in the document where you deal with strains of flu with homeopathic remedies, the remedies that you would select based upon the diarrhea and the vomiting are going to be the same remedies that you're going to use if it truly was a flu. So defining it as flu or defining it as eating improperly, you know, getting an upset stomach and having these very bad symptoms, nobody likes to do vomiting and diarrhea, that it doesn't really matter what we call it. But if you gather the symptoms, you're going to come up with a homeopathic remedy that will hopefully alleviate the problem.
Yeah, well, it'll stimulate your immune system in the way it's attempting to do it anyway. And mm-hmm. we have to understand that even if you take the homeopathic remedy and you're vomiting still, or you have more diarrhea, it should not be as violent as it had been in the beginning. But you have to understand that vomiting and diarrhea is your body's method of removing or releasing from you some foreign bug or virus or whatever that is causing you to
a toxin.
Right. So you don't want to stop the diarrhea or the vomiting. What you want to do is you want to make it more effective. So the next time you take the orange arsenicum, you might have vomiting again, but it might be more effective to the point where it just gives up everything, or the diarrhea will actually get out what it is that's in there attempting to eject. And so you may continue to have diarrhea or vomiting, but it won't be as ineffectual.
And that goes also for fever. So this is really fascinating for people who do not understand that we do not just want to suppress a symptom to just make ourselves most comfortable and stop the symptom, but we want the body's natural innate functioning to be enhanced. So fever is an important immune function. And if we have fever, we don't just want to eliminate it. We want the body to counteract a bacteria or a virus with this natural means.
Right. We want to make it effectual. So we want the fever to cook all of the disease, the bacterium or the correct bacterium out of your system and the correct virus that is causing you the distress without causing you distress. So the fever may go higher, but the person may find themselves go into a nice, good, healthy, healing sleep. And their head isn't pounding anymore, and they feel very, very at peace, and they feel very, very, very comfortable. And now they're not moaning, they're not crying, they're not carrying on, they're not feeling distressful. Now they're very, very peaceful, and the fever is allowed to do its job. And that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why when you have a fever, you do not eat. So that old wives' tale is, feed a cold, starve a fever. That means that when you're having a fever, do not eat solid foods. Drink liquids. Don't drink highly sugared liquids. Do not eat, everybody wants to give you, when you're having diarrhea, a little bit of crackers to eat. You're better off to take some ginger tea and sip on it, even if you can't sip on, you can't drink it in gulps. If you could just sip on it slowly, an Ayurvedic answer to indigestion and diarrhea is to get some hot water, some steeping hot water, and not even put anything in it. Just sip on it slowly like you would some hot tea or hot cocoa. And it actually stimulates the liver to release the cholesterol necessary to help you to digest your food. And the reason why you do not want to feed a fever is because your body is attempting to use its liver to do some cleansing of your intestinal tract. Many times people will take enemas when they have fevers to lower that fever, because they know that their bowels are clogged, and if they clean their bowels out, the fever will reduce, because they have bacterium that the body is trying to fight in all ways. So again, if you sip on hot liquid, the ginger tea is actually, in Chinese medicine, a warmer. It will warm you. It will help your guts to warm. It will help your liver to release the necessary things that it has to, especially the cholesterol. You want the gallbladder to release the cholesterol. Even people who claim that, I don't have a gallbladder anymore, doesn't make any difference. Your liver understands all of that. Your gallbladder is just kind of like a little bladder there to hold it so that it doesn't go out quickly. But the liver is still manufacturing that cholesterol, still pushing out all of those quote-unquote gallstones. They're really liver stones, and they're still being pushed out. They just don't have to go through any kind of a bowel duct anymore. Or they do go through a bowel duct, but they don't have to go through into the gallbladder through another little duct out of your system if you don't have a gallbladder. It just is an open, free space. It just goes out on its own. But nonetheless, you're aiding your body to do its job properly. And if you feed yourself any kind of chicken noodle soup, for instance, with high amounts of noodles and crackers, what you're doing is you're clogging up your intestinal tract, and now your liver cannot function in its best method. So then
you're correcting me, because yesterday I talked about chicken soup as being mother's penicillin,
well,
which
it's very good as a broth, but you don't eat the noodles and the vegetables.
Okay, great. So we're clear on that. Clear.
Yeah, broth. It's a broth without the matzahs. That's all.
I want to mention to folks who are listening on the chat, if you need to or would like to call in to comment or question, you can either leave a comment in the chat room, or you can call in to 347-945-6956 if you're in the United States. If you're elsewhere, you can click that blue Skype button and call in to talk to us. We love to answer questions on the air. My question to you, Phyllis, is, you know, this is incredible how the body has the potential and ability to heal itself, and allowing the fever to work or the other parts of the functions of the body to work, that it knows how to use the fever to eliminate the bacteria or virus that is alien or foreign or unhealthy, but it remains to leave the good bacteria. I don't understand how that is possible. Maybe
well,
you
I don't understand how that is possible either. You're going to have to ask God about that one. But, you know, to be honest with you, some lady yesterday was saying to me, you know, she's all upset and bent out of shape because she was told that she's got Lyme disease and she's got all these parasites. And, oh, well, how will homeopathy get rid of it? Where will the parasites go? Will I be very sick? Will I have diarrhea? Will I be throwing up all these ugly parasites? And I say, no, probably not. Probably you'll just absorb them. What do you mean I'll absorb them? I said, well, they just don't live there anymore, and so they just don't exist anymore. So most of the time, they just go away. And the thing of it is that I don't know how that happens. I'm not a quantum physicist. I don't understand that. But I do understand that the body is the most magnificent organism. everything from trees and grass and worms to human beings. We are most magnificent, and we have every bit of pharmacy that we need within us. And just because we can't intellectualize or figure this out in our little pea brains, our bodies still know what to do. And so we have to just allow it. And that's what is the beauty of homeopathy. It allows the immune system, it gives honor to the fact that we don't know these things, and it allows the immune system to deal with itself in its own wisdom. And we have, as a species, been around for at least 250,000 years on this planet, and as a result, we've only had, quote-unquote, modern medicine within the last 100 years, 130 years. I think that we've had a lot of people in and off this planet for all those millennia. I think that we really know what we're doing. We do not need modern medicine to make us different, to genetically modify us, or to come in and give us genetically modified foods or whatever. Modern medicine really is very much conjecture. They've gotten to the point where they don't allow anybody to say that they can cure anything holistically or not, because they know they can't cure anything. So they,
oh, wow.
They tell you basically that you're just going to have to live with this disease, and here's the medication you can use in order to help you live with this disease. And this medication will eventually not work, and so we'll have to use this medication. And because this medication has side effects, you're going to have to take this medication. And so we know that this is the scenario. I'm 60 years old. I don't take any medications at all, and I know many people younger than myself who take at least five, if not more.
I think that the elderly have up to like an average of 17 drugs a day. I think
right.
I read that somewhere. I mean, this is crazy.
I remember back in the 90s, they were making some kind of a comment that on the average, and this was just like for a healthcare HMO or something. It had to do with the news, but anyway, they were saying that the average American uses 7 to 9 antibiotics a year, annually. And I looked around at my family, which of course haven't had any antibiotics. One of my children had never had any antibiotics in his life. And I look around and I say, well, who's getting our 7 to 9?
Exactly. So that's an average 7 to 9. There are people taking 20 once a month, or are on antibiotics prophylactically to prevent, like all of the people who have to go to the dentist and they have heart trouble. So every time they go to the dentist, they have to take an antibiotic to prevent infection.
Right, and I'm one of those people who has a mitral valve prolapse, so I'm one of the people that they wanted to get to have an antibiotic every time I went in for dental work, and I would just laugh at them and say, no, I don't think so. And then as a homeopath, you know, when people come to me and they say this, my simple answer is to take Hypericum, which is a homeopathic remedy made from St. John's wort. Make it in either a 30C potency or a 2LM or a 3LM or a 1M potency, and just put it in some water. Take it 3 times a day, starting 3 days before you go in. Go in that morning, take it several times, and actually put it into a bottle, like a water bottle, and have it there available for you while you're having your dental work, so that if they want you to swish your mouth and spit, you can shake up your bottle of your homeopathic Hypericum and swish it in your mouth and spit it in the sink.
Oh, they don't have that anymore. You'll have to purse your lips together so that the machine can suck it out.
Suck it out. Okay. Well,
okay,
then,
so
you can do this before you go in. And then afterwards, you have your Hypericum you continue to take afterwards. And then you take your Arnica and your Hypericum and interchange them every 5 to 10 minutes for about an hour, and then just go on to the Arnica and stick with it and just add the Hypericum in. The Hypericum is actually it prevents infection. And if there's any infection going on, it also, if there's any infection that might go through your bloodstream that might get into your heart, it will prevent that. It will also aid to maintain the nerves so that they grow back properly in your teeth and whatever damage they're doing. I mean, simple things like getting your teeth cleaned can be highly dangerous. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why they started these antibiotics as prophylactic. But you have to understand, too, that antibiotics were never meant to be prophylaxis.
Right.
They're meant to be, they are not used in a prophylactic manner because they kill good and bad bacterium. Anti meaning against, and biotic meaning life. It is against life. It kills life. So anytime you have too much antibiotic, you're killing your good bacteria in your stomach, and yeast is growing rampantly. The reason we have MRSA, which is basically, MRSA is just an acronym for a certain type of antibiotic resistant
I can't pronounce
it. Yeah,
I
can never pronounce it either, never remember it, don't care to.
Well, it's a resistant strain of Staphylococcus. And, you know, I want to mention that all of the listeners who have been on today's show, we've been talking, we're going to be going for 2 hours straight. This show is an educational broadcast. It's informative. It is not a prescription. It is not a diagnosis. It's not taking care of your medical condition. You need to see your healthcare provider, your homeopath, for individualized care. Homeopathy is based on individual care of matching symptoms and understanding who you are and what you need to assist your immune system. So this is just information. These are stories that we have. This is knowledge, a knowledge base of over 200 years. So I just wanted to emphasize that for the listeners.
Right, and it's a knowledge base of mine for 30 years. And knowledge base of yours for whatever years you've been doing this. I know I've known you at least 15 of those
20,
30.
20.
Okay, 20 of those years. So that's a long time. I mean, you and I have collectively 50 years of knowledge using this form of healthcare.
Uh-huh.
For amazingly difficult situations that, quote-unquote, modern medicine has not been able to find cures for.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, I mean, it's not that we've gotten here because of our good looks or that we've made tons and tons of money at this before. We have not. We've done this because this is the right thing to do, because it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's healthy, and it makes us healthy. And again, I'm 60 years old, and I don't have any medications that I take. And people look at me and never recognize that I'm 60 years old. And I've known people in my own family who are younger than I am who take medications and who certainly do not look healthy.
Well, I don't know if we can all base it on looks, because some young people do drop to the ground without knowledge about certain things, like athletes. They will go out and all of a sudden they're dead from running around the track or whatever.
Yeah.
So we don't really know what's going on inside the body based on always on what it, the appearance is, although we do use a lot of that in homeopathy. We have about 15 minutes or 17 minutes left to the show. What would you like to talk about continuing on now? We've gone all over the place. And it's been great, because every single bit of this information is important for people to know about how to care for ourselves. And that's one of the important things about the miracle. I'm calling it a miracle. I'm calling it a mystery. But it's actually a science and a medicine, a form of medicine to use homeopathy. But why we say it's miraculous is because of what the example you gave, that if a person does have parasites, as if in Lyme's disease, and you wonder how it's going to do the cure, we don't really have the answer to how it works specifically. We know that if you go to sleep at night with a lot of congestion, phlegm, and mucus, and you get the right remedy, and you wake up in the morning and it's clear, you wonder, where did it all go? 'Cause you didn't.
Right. It's called basically your lymphatic system. Your lymphatic system is a wonderful thing. It's like little pearls all over your body. We notice them as buboes or lymph nodes on our necks and under our arms and in our groin, and that's where the largest ones are. But we have these like little pearls of lymph that go all over our body, and what happens is that our bodies are able to muster the lymph to release all of this congestion through our kidneys. And many people will wake up after a night of congestion and the homeopathic is working, and they'll have a whole lot of urine. Their bladder is really full. And they'll go, wow, where'd that all come from? Well, that all came from your lungs. That all came from your nose. And what people don't recognize is that the lymphatic system needs motion. It's not like your heart where you have systolic and diastolic, where you pump it in and push it out, pump it in and push it out. Your lymphatic system works on you moving around, and so it's kind of like a toothpaste tube. You squeeze it out. You can't put the toothpaste back into the tube again.
Right.
Squeeze it out. So that's basically how it works. And
so that you're telling us, get up and move. Don't sit sedentary all day long. Now that you said that, I'm going to have to move myself around in my chair. And,
yep.
You know, do the movement, do the shoulder rolls, do the neck rolls.
Right.
Get up and move your hips from side to side. Put on some music. If we don't go a day without moving our body, we are going to stagnate. And then we won't be able to clear all that stuff from the lymph system.
Right. And that's the reason why the elderly people tend to become more sick than a young child would. In fact, there are some MDs, and I've had the wonderful fortune, the wonderful God-given ability to find these guys, and they would say to me when my ex-husband was trying to make me get these kids an antibiotic and get them an antibiotic, and my mother works in an elderly home, all these people have this, and they're all on these antibiotics. He would say to me simply, this is a four-year-old. He's running around and jumping. This is not congesting in him. Those people in that old age home are elderly. They're sitting in chairs or they're laying down, and they have no way of moving their lymphatic systems around.
Right.
And so that, you know, it was like great to hear an MD make this statement to me as a young mother who was trying desperately just to use the homeopathy and not, you know, saying it's okay that this kid has the cough. Doesn't have a fever. He's just coughing. So it sounds bad. So what are you, embarrassed because your kid's coughing? You know, I'm happy that my kid has lungs and the ability to cough. You know, there are children who have cystic fibrosis who can't do this.
Right.
It's
the body's way of clearing. You finish that line of thought, and then I have another question for you.
Well, basically, a lot of people are just so, they've been so disoriented in the belief that we must control fevers and we have to stop colds and runny noses. And this is where all the prescription over-the-counter medications to suppress coughs, to suppress nose discharges. Well, you suppress nose discharges in a small child. Their eustachian tube from their sinuses back to their ear is wee tiny. You stop them from blowing their noses or getting anything out of their nose, it's going to...
I just lost your sound.
Oh.
Hold on. Are you there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, you were saying that if you stop them from eliminating from their noses and...
It goes, all the pressure builds, all the mucus builds back toward their little eustachian tubes, and the kids end up with ear infections, and then they have to cart them off to the hospital, or to the doctor to get an antibiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ridiculous. So stop worrying about fevers. Fevers are your friend. Love your fever. Enjoy your fever. Find a homeopathic remedy that fits your symptoms. And if you have just a fever and nothing else, then give yourself some ferrum phos, iron phosphate, homeopathic, 6X. Put it into some water, shake it up, and take tiny sips of it. You'll be amazed how you'll get that wonderful fever to do the perfect job for you to cure your problem. And you won't even know why you had that fever, and you don't need to know why you had that fever. It's not an interest of your body. You need to know... You need to allow your body to have that fever and have a nice, restful sleep and let that fever do its work.
Okay, so now you've given me more than one question to ask. So I think about ferrum phos as a tissue salt, a cell salt for the body, for when you have a fever with no other symptoms. Is it for a quick onset of a fever or a slow onset, or does it not matter?
It doesn't matter at all.
Okay.
If this is a fever and you say they don't have any other symptom, put it this way, ferrum phos is for one symptom. They have an earache. There's no other symptom. They don't have a fever. They don't have a cough. They don't have a headache. They have an earache. They have a headache. you know, or you were talking about fever, or they have a sore throat. There's no other symptom, just a sore throat. Give them Ferrum Floss. 6X and 12X seems to be the most perfect of potencies. 30C doesn't seem to work so well. I do like the LMs. Now, 1LM and 2LM seem to be just perfect. But again, you have to put it in water. You've got to shake it up. Taking it dry continuously doesn't work. But if you shake, even if you find, you know, what I've been noticing is that I don't need to take and buy these dropper bottles that are quite expensive and or anything of that nature. What I do is I tell people, just go out to your convenience store and buy a glass bottle of iced tea. Mm-hmm. Dump out the iced tea.
How about kombucha?
Right, kombucha. There you go. There you can drink your kombucha, and it's a good bottle. But find yourself a good glass bottle. I mean, even if you're saving spaghetti sauce jars.
Or a beer.
A beer, right.
There you go. There's a bottle. You have
but
to have a good top on it.
Put, it's something you can put a stopper on or a lid in or a lid on or something that you so you can shake it. And just you can fill it up 3/4 of the way with water. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a 1/2 ounce of water, 4 ounces of water, 17 ounces of water. It just depends upon how you have the ability to shake that bottle so that you can get good action in there for the succussion. And then just take small sips of it or pour it. If you've got one of those bottles that you could just squirt it into your mouth and squirt it into your mouth, you could literally put it into a bottle where you could have a spray and just shake it up and spray it down your throat or spray it on your skin. You don't even need to put it in your mouth.
That's right, because Hahnemann taught us the many ways of taking the remedy, either olfactory, just smelling it.
Right. I mean, and people were very, you know, like years ago, people didn't believe me when I said this. And some of them would try it and it would work and others wouldn't. But nowadays we see all these Nicoderm patches and these testosterone patches and these patches they put on people that are supposed to give them their memory back when they have Alzheimer's. So we know that it gets through the skin. And so does homeopathy. Homeopathy will affect you that way. So people should recognize truthfully that the fluoride and the chlorine in the water that they're taking a bath in could very well be affecting them adversely.
Okay, we're going to save that topic for another day.
Okay.
But we have about 7 minutes, and I wanted to ask you another question that related to something that you spoke about just a little while ago, and that was about movement of the body. Exercise, getting the lymphatic system going, massage is a really fabulous way to do that. Now, I don't know if you were able to hear my show yesterday, but I touched upon this breaking news that was published that they are telling us that if you exercise when you before and or after your flu shot, that it will make the flu shot more productive or more, I don't know whether, it will be more efficacious based upon their the antibody count in the body. And we talked a lot about the fact that antibodies really isn't the answer to your immune system, and it may not be protecting you. However, that is how the medical system looks at it. And just theoretically, because you're so smart, Phyllis, if you do more exercise before or after an injection, why would the antibody count go up?
Okay, well, let's just look at a whole different, you may think this is a whole different or a non sequitur, but let's say you get bit by a snake. It's a poisonous snake. What's the first thing you're supposed to do? Do you have any idea?
Wrap it up and don't let, you know, it go through the
don't let it go through the system because
right.
If it goes through the system, it's going to create more antibodies and it's going to go right to your heart and cause you whatever disease it's going to cause or whatever problem. Most of the time, snake venoms cause your heart to stop. It eats away at your internal organs so that the snake basically bites its prey in order to get it to pre-digest. So what's happening is that venom is pre-digesting your system. So let's look at this as far as injection of a vaccination.
It's kind of the same, isn't it?
It's kind of the same. Yes, it is. Because you're being pricked, in the same way, and you're being injected with a venom.
Right.
It is going through the system faster, and it will go to your heart faster. What they're hoping is that you will sweat out some of the problems. The problem, in my estimation, is that you're just going to spread this faster. And I've known of many people who've been force vaccinated, whether it was in they were in the service or had to, or were put in jail for some reason, had to go to a county jail for some reason, and were injected with a tuberculosis, not vaccine, but a tuberculentine test. What they would do is they would try to prick it and hold it into that spot and try to milk it out of their system, or they would try to open it up somehow and break that open so that it would come out rather than go into their system.
Oh.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get you to get this to go through your system faster.
Uh-huh.
And in the cases of...
Maybe further. Maybe the faster it goes, the more far-reaching it will get to
right.
all of the different cells and distributed further in your body. And they also, not only do they look at antibodies as supposedly your protection, they look at the fever component. So will you get a fever that is higher or more sustained? Another example of a study they did with a group of people is they tested a vaccine, and their placebo group wasn't just saline solution. It was a triple vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
And the triple vaccine group had a longer-term fever. It lasted 10 days or longer than the actual group that got the vaccine they were trying to examine. So, I mean, methodology is questionable when we get these research outcomes. We only hear on the media news, headline. Headline says vaccine is better than placebo. And until you dig deeper and understand the methodology and the numbers and the statistics and what they're looking for to make that conclusion, most people won't really know what it means.
Well, the facts of the vaccine, when they say that it's better than placebo, it's not that they're giving you a saline solution. They're not putting in the viruses, but they're still putting in all the formaldehyde and the mercury and the triple antibiotics and all the other things that they do with it. And that's really the key as to why you get sick. All those other things, the mercury, the thimerosal, the other things in it make you sick. And the virus that they put into you it just makes you doubly sick. So
right.
Everybody who's getting these placebo, quote unquote, it's not a placebo. It's not just clear water they're injecting you with. And they don't want to show the difference between someone who is non-vaccinated at all versus somebody who is vaccinated. In fact, they're trying to put together a study of children or people who are non-vaccinated versus the vaccine group, because they know that there's a lot of non-vaccinated people. The problem is that those non-vaccinated people don't want to be identified as non-vaccinated people.
Right.
Because they don't want to be placed onto a list. And that's what they're afraid of. It's a very scary thing. In many ways, it sounds very Nazi and tyrannical.
People right, and
on list.
Yeah, and it's really what we were talking about in the first hour with Greg
right.
Glazer, our constitutional lawyer, about tyranny in America and living naturally and healthfully. And I want to tell you how much I enjoyed speaking with you today. Our time has flown by for the second hour, and I know that we've got lots of guests who are listening in today, and there will be maybe 1,000 downloads or more of today's show. So for any of the guests who want Phyllis to come back and speak with us, please send me some feedback, send me a comment or question of something that you want her to address. You can email me at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com, or you can go on to the Homeopathy World Community Facebook page and send me a message there. Phyllis, you're just a joy and full of that 30 years of knowledge of
Thank
healthcare.
You. Thank you. I've worked at this hard, but I do it because it's a heartfelt thing for me, and I use it, and I don't think anything badly of anybody who doesn't, but certainly this is the way, and I love it, and it works.
Thank you. We're creating waves of awareness. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.